Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Francisco. It's nice to see you.
Likewise. What's on your mind today?
I love getting to know people who are living extraordinary lives. And you've heard me say it often, that I love to talk to people, just ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things in the world. And also finding creative ways to balance our mental health and well-being, because that's kind of the whole essence of our lives, is that we need to find a path that supports our mental health and well-being and the mental health and well-being of those we love and are responsible for. And there's a lot of creative ways that we get there. So my guest today covers that aspect, an ordinary person doing extraordinary things. And also, it's a topic that we've touched on a few times over the last few months about trauma and victims' rights and dealing with the legal system and how we as a country, as a culture, as a community, are either helping or failing to meet the needs of those who have been victimized or have been traumatized or continue to be traumatized. And so that is also in keeping with that theme. But before I jump in to today's topic, I just wanted to acknowledge my interns for this last few months, because it's the first time that I've actually had interns from Cal Poly who have been part of the program. And Sasha is here with us today. Sasha and Sophie have been my interns. And they have brought in some really interesting topics the last few months. So I don't want to take any credit for some of the great guests we've had over the last few months. I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge Sasha Briginski, who is here. Say hello, Sasha.
Hi. Thank you, Elizabeth.
And also to thank you for doing such great work in bringing in interesting guests. And I hope that before you leave and set out into the world, that you'll send me a few more good guests along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure to be here.
And also, Sasha is going to be a guest in the next few weeks to talk about her experience at Poly, being a first-gen student, and some of her experiences in the world. So I'm looking forward to that. So thank you, Sasha. So today's topic kind of came to us, or today's guest came to us through another guest that we had a few weeks ago, Jennifer Storm. You might have remembered our conversation. Jennifer has a very compelling life story. She is the author of Blackout Girl, about her experiences being assaulted when she was young and going through the legal system and not getting any support and becoming, through her sheer willpower, grit, and perseverance, getting a degree, getting a job as the victim's advocate for the state of Pennsylvania. So if you missed that show, please go back and find my conversation with Jennifer Storm. I've talked to her actually twice if you wanted to find those conversations. Sasha might even, if she's feeling up to it, find those and post them on her Facebook page so you can listen to them again. But Jennifer, at the end of our last conversation said, you know, I really think you need to speak with Meg Garvin, because she's the executive director of this organization that I'm a part of. And she'd be a great guest because her life is absolutely fascinating. And so I want to thank Jennifer for connecting me to Meg Garvin, who is our guest today. And her life story is also going to be compelling and interesting. So I'm not going to hang out and talk too much more. But just to welcome you into the show today, I am Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of the conversation by finding us on our Facebook page. You can leave messages there. We update the show. You can find us on Instagram, The Reluctant Therapist. Shows are updated there as well. I think Sasha got a picture from the Zoom. If you wanted to check that out, she'll post it to her Instagram. You can leave messages. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us through, listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org. And all of my shows for the last 10 years, I think we counted over 400 shows that you can revisit at the website. Or you can podcast the show. If you'd like to get the current shows uploaded, just go to wherever you find podcasts, find a conversation with a reluctant therapist, hit subscribe, leave a review, and the shows will show up. And although we can't take calls over the air, we can take questions and comments. So our number is 805-549-8855. Francisco loves to get a call and he loves to read the comments or questions over the air. So please participate as you are comfortable. And so without any further ado, I'd like to welcome you into the conversation. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to talk with Meg Garvin, the Executive Director for the National Crime Victim Law Institute at Lewis and Clark School of Law. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I would never make it, but I was built to break the mold. The only dream that I've been chasing is my own. So I sing a song for the hustlers trading at the bus stop, single mothers waiting on a check to come, young teachers, student doctors, sons on the front line knowing they don't get to run. This goes up to the underdog. Keep on keeping at what you love and you'll find that someday soon enough you will rise up. Back to the kitchen, talking to the driver about his wife and his children. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And welcome to my guest today, Meg Garvin. Hello, Meg.
Hello. Thanks for having me here.
All right. So you might not get a chance to talk because by the time I finish reading your bio, our hour might be over. But let me do my due diligence because I want everyone to know a little bit about who you are and then you'll get a chance to clarify. Meg Garvin is a lawyer by training, but she is also the executive director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute at Lewis and Clark School of Law, where she is also a clinical professor. Professor Garvin is recognized as a leading expert on victims' rights and the co-author of Victims in Criminal Procedure. In 2017, Professor Garvin was appointed by the Secretary of Defense to serve on the Defense Advisory Committee on Investigation, Prosecution, and Defense of Sexual Assault in the Armed Forces. This is a role that she continues to fill today, along with her other responsibilities. Professor Garvin also serves on the Victims Advisory Group of the U.S. Sentencing Commission and the Oregon Chief Justice's Criminal Justice Advisory Committee. In 2020, Meg received the Frank Carrington Crime Victim Attorney Award. And I actually left a few things out because I was afraid we would get to the end of the hour. Professor Garvin originally practiced in Minneapolis before coming to Oregon. She received her MA from the University of Iowa, her JD from the University of Minnesota, and her MST in International Human Rights Law from the University of Oxford. So I don't even know where to start, Professor Garvin, but I guess I would like to start with, how did you find your way on this path? What was the beginning of this journey for you?
Well, thank you. And thank you for not doing more of my bio. You know, you write those things for like the website and stuff. And then when you hear them, you're like, oh, golly. But, you know, my path has been both direct and indirect, which sounds odd, but it's true. I went to graduate school thinking in communication theory, rhetorical theory, thinking I would become a professor. And when I was there at the University of Iowa, it was too theoretical for me, right? I needed to like be in the trenches and do something. So I thought, law school, right? And so I dropped out of grad school before I finished my degree, my PhD. And I eventually went to law school with the intention of doing criminal defense work. Because when I looked around and thought, how can I look at language and law and human beings and actually try to have an impact? The system I saw hurting humans the most was criminal justice. And the human I saw was the defendant. And so I went to law school to become a public defender. And during law school, I was actually victimized myself in comparatively mild way. And I'm not trying to minimize my own victimization, but I happened to have support systems around me and I was able to thrive after it. But I also needed to step away from public defense. I was an intern at the public defender's office. And so I kind of meandered for a while I did civil law. My appellate work, my pro bono work was still public defense, but I was trying to figure out what I could do. And I saw this job posting. So I'm in Minnesota and I see a job posting for NCVLI, the National Crime Victim Law Institute. And it was just starting. It said, be a victim's attorney. And I thought to myself, what the heck is that? And actually, my inner vocabulary is a little less polite than heck, because I was like, I've been a victim. They don't have lawyers. What are you talking about? And I looked into it and I thought, gosh, there is a second human being in the criminal justice system. So I interviewed in November of 2002 and I packed my bags and moved cross country to take the job in 2003.
And so you didn't intend to go into law school then when you were younger. This wasn't a path. Everything just kind of was doors opening.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I often tell the students with whom I work that, right, our lives are just an arc of telling a story, right? And the story, every chapter is totally different. It just keeps changing and you never know what the next one's going to be. I have never known what I'm doing next. I've never done a traditional route. Every job I've gotten has been kind of yes, I worked hard. I'm not going to diminish my own. Like I try very hard not to like self-deprecate, but also a whole lot of luck, a whole lot of kind and generous people, and a whole lot of just, oh gosh, look at that door. Maybe I should give it a shot.
Are your parents lawyers by chance?
No. My father was, he's passed away. He was a hardware engineer and my mom was a software engineer. So there was a lot of math and science in my house, none of which I understood a word of. None of it.
And so what did you do undergraduate in? What was the original?
Communications and political science.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So there was a little inkling. I'm just always so fascinated because, you know, generally we tend to find our way a little bit through what our parents did or, you know, having been exposed to it in some way. But it seems like the law called you more than you wanted to go to the law.
The law became a place. So when I was in communication studies, I became fascinated with language and how language constitutes community, right? So like my word choices, you can start to, and the way I speak, you could start to identify where I'm from, right? If I use soda versus pop, right? Like for drinking something, if I say Hawaii with a certain accent, you might know that I have connections to Hawaii. And so language started to become this thing about community for me. And then I started to look at what else constitutes community besides vocabulary and words. And I was really drawn to that law really starts to constitute our communities. Like what behaviors are we going to accept? Who are we going to respect? Who aren't we? And so it became just another place for me to investigate the notion of community.
I like that. And the other thing that I know about law, or just of my friends that are lawyers or went to law school, is that you have to really find a niche, because law school, being a lawyer in law school is not that fun unless you have some sort of strange penchant for it. Is that true?
Yeah, I enjoyed my colleagues during law school. I'm not a person that loved law school. You know, you go, what you see on TV is that you could be, you know, a tort lawyer, right? So it's always an age test too, right? So I'm like, you can be on, you know, LA Law. And people are like, what is that? And I'm like, oh, golly, yes, you're younger than me, right? But like you find, so you can be like the lawyer that sues people for money. You can be a prosecutor or a defense attorney, right? That's kind of what you see in the world. And when you get to law school, you start to go down that path and then you start to see, oh my gosh, there's so many other things you can do with your JD. And finding kind of which thing feeds your soul, you know, and how does it? So like, I'm not a trial lawyer. I don't go into court every day because that would crush me. I would have such high anxiety. So instead, I like to think about law, do appellate work, help other lawyers do their jobs, because that feeds me, and then I can do sustainable work. So yeah, you have to find what really feeds you. And law, there's actually a lot of options. But if you think that you can do it and just, you know, not have a passion for it, you should do something else.
And so finding your way to Oregon, let's talk about what brought you there, which was this work with the National Crime Victim Law Institute, NCVLI, I guess we can refer to it as. Talk a bit about this program and why you you decided you were going to become a part of it?
Yeah. So when I saw the posting, and it was so NCBLI was receiving a federal grant to start a national project to kind of test the theory of whether survivors of crime could have better personal outcomes from criminal justice if they had a lawyer. So it was just a concept at the time. And it's not about outcomes of the criminal case. It's more about, like, would they feel more empowered? When I saw this job posting, become a victim's lawyer, I thought to myself, A, what is that? And B, you know, like, is there space for it in criminal justice? Because, right, even I would guess all of the listeners, if you picture a criminal courtroom, there's two lawyers, right? Prosecution, defense, and there's the judge. So I was really curious about it. And I called the then executive director, Doug Ballouf, and I said, and he was a professor. And I said, I want to talk to you about this. Like, tell me, what on earth is it? And I really wanted to make sure I wasn't getting into a political entity, because it's not political for me. It's about the human being. And I don't want to take a position on certain sentencing. I don't want to take a position on, you know, the way we structure, like, crime. I want to take a position on how, and I want to help a victim navigate their own life experience. And when I talked to him about it, he, you know, talked about that it was a civil rights approach. It's about NCVLI's entire mission comes down to one piece of punctuation, the apostrophe. So if you write victims' rights without an apostrophe, victim is an adjective on the rights.
Okay.
But if you put victims, V-I-C-T-I-M, apostrophe S, rights, they own the right. Right? And so we have to ask people, what do you need? What do you want? How can I help you exercise your rights? And as soon as I learned that it was about the apostrophe and that what I was going to be doing is serving someone else on their path, that was it, right? And so NCVLI is really all about, the laws say you have rights, but no one really pays, historically, no one's paid much attention to them. In fact, I would guess most of the listeners can't recite their rights. They could all recite their Miranda rights. Everyone can recite your Miranda rights, right? I have the right to remain silent. I have a right to an attorney, right? But if you're a victim of crime, you can't recite them. And so NCVLI's mission is all about that darn apostrophe and making sure people know their rights so that they can choose their path as they move through their surviving.
How is having a lawyer for the victim different than having the advocate that work at Jennifer does as a victim's advocate?
Yeah, that's a great question, Elizabeth. So it is really, survivors need both. Right. So one of the things I often both joke about and I'm serious about is that law school doesn't teach me as a lawyer to speak with other human beings. Right. I was taught to speak at you or to argue with you. Right. And a survivor needs someone who holds better space than that for them. And advocates are trained to hold space, right, for survivors. I feel like I'm getting better as a lawyer at it. But what I can do that the advocate can't do is argued to the court. And so I don't know if you have seen a criminal courtroom, but even on TV or your listeners, right? You see the courtroom and there's always the judge up front and then there's two tables, right? There's the prosecution, the defense. And then there's usually like a little bar or a gate, right? And then everyone else sits behind it. Mm-hmm. So when you're a lawyer and you get admitted to the bar, that means I get to walk in front of that gate. That's the bar. And I can go in front of it and talk to the judge. So when I have a client, the advocate is helping the client with all of their myriad needs. I get to take that client's apostrophe, go in front and argue it to the court. So a survivor really needs both. So like, I wouldn't want to do my job without someone like Jennifer.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And my guest today is Meg Garvin. She is the executive director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute, which is located at the Lewis and Clark School of Law, where she's also a clinical professor. And so we're learning about this world of victims' rights. And if I hadn't met Jennifer, I wouldn't know that there was a whole world of advocacy for victims. I would sit on the side of someone who has watched a lot of people try to exercise their Title IX rights and become secondarily traumatized again. And so I would say that I'm the reluctant And I'm reluctant in that path. And can we talk about how those two are connected? Because I think a lot of people don't come forward for assaults or batteries or with a Title IX because they feel they are going to be continually traumatized. How do we fix that? And has it been fixed at all? Or is that what you're doing?
So that's what we're trying to do, is help fix it. Yeah. So you're so right that, you know, the way the system, whether it is Title IX, so campus, whether it's criminal justice, whether it's getting a darn, you know, protective order, right, which is a civil moment. Our systems, particularly Title IX and the criminal justice system, they're kind of set up like conveyor belts, like kind of cookie cutter, not a lot of time for the individual human being, and really incident based. Like, tell me about this part of you, Elizabeth. What happened on that night? What were you wearing? Why'd you go out? Right? This really narrow approach to your experience. And that's part of what causes the re-traumatization, because essentially you are then minimized and treated like a piece of evidence in your own case, or you know, a witness to your own victimization. What victims' rights and what Title IX is supposed to do is really reinsert you back into the story. So if we're going to figure out what, how were you harmed and how can we help you with your harm, we have to talk with you, right? I mean, like, that's the bottom line. And so victims' rights, Title IX rights, all of it is about trying to get the survivor back in the conversation, to stop having it be about the state and the defendant, the university and the accused, right? To start having it be about the human beings in the mix, both the accused and the survivor, and say, what happened? How do we help you? So has it been fixed? It certainly hasn't. I mean, I literally, right before coming on this podcast, was dealing with a darn subpoena for a victim's cell phone, where they want everything. I mean, I don't know about you guys, right? But think about what's on your cell phone right now. And all that really matters in the case is are two texts between two people. But what the system wants is the whole phone dumped. Who's ever going to participate if you have to give over your whole phone? I wouldn't want to, at least. So we're trying to fight to say, no, you don't get it. So yeah, it's an ongoing. I hope by the time I leave this world, it's fixed. That would be a dream.
So are there a set of victims' rights like the Miranda rights that you cited? And can you cite the victim rights?
Yeah. So in every jurisdiction, so every state has something. So 35 states, I think it's 35 now. Ooh, my students will correct me if I'm wrong, have put in their constitutions, right? Their state constitution rights for victims. And every other state has statutes. The federal government has statutes, and even the military has statutes affording victims' rights. They're all a little bit different, but they can fall into a couple of categories. I tend to remember the categories instead of the specifics, and you can remember the categories by the four P's. This is how I try to teach them. So, four P's of victims' rights: privacy, protection, participation, which there's a whole lot in there, but that's notice, presence, you get to be heard. And then property, you get to be restored financially. That last P doesn't really fit, but we tried to like come up with something clever to remember, right? So the four P's. In California, there's actually 17 rights articulated in the Constitution. In Oregon, I believe there are 8. Every jurisdiction has them slightly differently, but if you think about the four P's, you can find something about each of those in every state in the country.
And so because those rights exist, this might be a little off direction, but because those rights exist, would it then mean that if a victim felt re-victimized by the system, they could then in turn sue the state?
No. Well, there's a couple of jurisdictions that allow some level of suit, but the remedies, so the if it goes wrong, if your right is violated, the remedies that are available under victims' rights. I'm not going to, Title IX is different, right? Title IX, you actually can sue the school, right? And you can also sue the perpetrator. You always have the civil remedies. The square victims' rights remedies in criminal justice are all about making sure, again, that the victim's a part of things. So An example, if you were supposed to notify me, I'll give you actually a real case example. A plea hearing is happening, right? No one told the victim that the defendant, the accused, was going to change their plea from not guilty to guilty and go to sentencing right away. But I have a right to be notified, present, and heard at that, right? That's true everywhere. And you forget to tell me, right? Or you tell me 2 hours before and you're like, hey, show up at the hearing, right? And you're like, I have a kid or I have a pet. I can't get coverage or I'm caring for a senior, right? Or for goodness sakes, it's COVID. I can't get there, right? And the hearing happens anyhow. Then the remedy is to do it over. You strike it and you do it over. So my remedies are either a stop remedy, stop doing what you're doing because you're about to violate my rights. So in that example of the hearing, it would be continue it until a time I can get there, right? Stop the hearing, don't hold it. If you already have it, it's a do-over. And so it's really, I mean, really fundamentally, victims' rights are just about basic fairness. It happened to the victim. They should be a part of things along the way. And you shouldn't get to talk about their story or make decisions about their life without them in the conversation.
So I'd imagine from a psychological perspective, we're talking about closure and an ability to regain agency over our lives as victims. Would that be part of the goals?
I would absolutely echo that second part, the regaining of agency. For survivors, the notion of closure is generally totally elusive because it's more about, I usually articulate it more as closing this chapter, right? You're turning to the next chapter, but you are in victim language, normal, it's a new normal, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not, it's not pure closure. It's like, how do I articulate and walk a path of the new normal? But definitely, how do I do that with gaining agency back? How do I have control? How do I get to be the owner of my own story again?
Yeah, and I agree. It's because we're forever changed by everything that happens in our lives, and it forms our path moving forward. Just as you talked a little bit about your work as a public defender and then being victimized, it opened this whole different. So I always appreciate that you brought that up because I think that's so important that we tend to look at people's lives if trauma happens, that now we're broken and our life stops. And I think it's so important because you're all about language, that language is key in this, how we talk about that experience and that trauma and how we grow and reclaim our lives and come back stronger, different, whole is so important because I do think we have a language in this country that victimizes people, that makes them feel broken because we talk to them as if they're broken when something happens.
I think that's so important that folks shy away from the label victim, right? Mm-hmm. Even like the label victim, it's a description that something happened to me. It's not what I did, right? Something happened to me and I was victimized. I may claim the label survivor. I may claim the label thriver, right? Whatever it is, but victim isn't a bad word. It's a fact. I was victimized and someone hurt me. I think the language really matters and honoring the language really matters so that we can just help folks continue to choose their path as they move.
So, and the National Crime Victim Law Institute, I keep having to say it because I can't get it, say it as fast as you, NCVLI, what would be their goal? You know, when would this organization that you head up be able to say, this is what we wanted?
So probably two moments, right? One would be when everyone can recite their victims' rights, the same as defendants' rights. And other rights, right? Like civil rights, human rights. Like there's this wonderful old quote. Well, I don't even know the quote. There's this wonderful sentiment from a former Secretary General of the United Nations, Boutros-Ghali, who said something to the effect of the first step in a human rights movement is that people know they have rights, mm-hmm. right? So they can ask for them. That's the first step. Because if you don't know things can be better, you don't demand it. Right? You don't ask for it. If you don't know you have rights, you don't ask for them. So the first thing is if everyone knew that they had rights and that they could ask for more humane and dignified treatment from the system, that would be one moment. And then if the system actually said, yep, we're going to give you your rights. That'd be the second part. Then we're done.
So that always seems to be where we as a country are falling short these days, is that the institutions that are supposed to be protecting human beings are not living up to their part of the bargain, that the institutions that we have created themselves are part of what is victimizing or continuing to keep us broken. My guest today is Meg Garvin. She is the executive director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute at the Lewis and Clark School of Law, where she is also a clinical professor. We're talking about the work of victims' rights, or bringing about awareness of victims' rights. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to continue our conversation. And if you have a comment or question for my guest, our number is 805-549-8855. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Trails of troubles, roads of battle, paths of victory, we shall walk. I walk along the highway, I walk along the track. There's a one-way wind blowing, it was blowing at my back. Trails of troubles, roads of battle, paths of victory, we shall walk. The road, it might be dusty, it might sometimes get rough, but the good road is waiting, and boys, it ain't far off.
You're listening to A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, which continues right here. Elizabeth Barrett, take it away.
Thank you, Francisco. All right, Meg, I want to go back to your fabulous biography, because I started at the top of the show saying today this conversation was with an ordinary person who is doing extraordinary things. And we've touched on your extraordinary work with NCVLI at Lewis and Clark, but also there's a big part of your biography that starts, I don't know if it started in 2017, but you were appointed by the Secretary of Defense to serve on the Defense Advisory Committee on Investigation, Prosecution, and Defense of Sexual Assault in the Armed Forces, which is a role you're still continuing to serve. And how did you get involved with the military end of this part of the victims' rights work?
Yeah, and one clarification, that commission is on hold right now. As the administration changes, they always decide which commissions are going to stay and which commissions aren't. The prediction is that one will come back. So hopefully I'll get to serve some more, because certainly sexual assault in the military has not gone away. So my work with the military came, I'd have to look back, but I think it was 2011. And that was right when the military and the country was really starting to pay attention to that sexual violence in the military was still a problem. There had been decades of trying to deal with it, but it hit the media again, and people started to pay attention to it. And I remember it was fall of, I think it was 2011, and I got a call, and it was from the Judge Advocate Generals from the Air Force. And I'm not a military member, and I have members of my family who have served, but it's not my generation. So I'm not particularly familiar. And honestly, I thought, well, who is this? I don't know who this is, right? And then I realized it's the lawyer of the Air Force, right? The head person. And I take the call, and I'm like, oh my gosh. And it was General Harding, and he was saying, you know, they were trying to grapple with the problem in the military. And he said, do you have any game-changing ideas? And I am thinking to myself, how did you reach me? And it was basically a friend of a friend. We had a conversation about lawyers for victims and could they help the system? Because the system responds differently to lawyers. You know, criminal justice, civil justice responds differently to lawyers than lay people. It just does. So we had a conversation about lawyers for victims, and he said, great, I'm going to stand up a new branch of the JAG in the Air Force, and will you come train them? So that fall, a new branch of them, or a new service in the military, was stood up. They're called the Special Victims Council, or the Victims Legal Council in other branches. And they are lawyers for sexual assault victims. So every sexual assault victim in the military, whether they do a restricted or unrestricted report, gets their own lawyer to talk to them about their rights in a privileged setting. And from that moment forward, when we started to talk about it and started to talk about that survivors need their own lawyers in the military, I was just hooked on helping that population. And I shouldn't say helping that population, basically being an agent of change for that population. And so still to this day, literally the webinar I was on this morning was about how to serve military survivors.
So have you seen traction with this part of dealing with sexual assault in the military?
Absolutely. Is there still work to do? Absolutely. But what you see is the data coming out of the SVC and VLC programs are that survivors that have lawyers in those systems report less trauma symptoms from interaction with the system. They report higher satisfaction, not with case outcome, right? Because it's not really always about that, but more with about whether they felt empowered, whether they felt served, and whether they feel like they have a choice about whether to stay in the service or separate. And for me, that's one of the most important moments, is someone chose to go into the military, and making sure that they have the space to choose to stay or choose to leave, not feel forced out because of their victimization, is so important. And that the data seems to be supporting it.
It's interesting because part of my volunteer work is with a group called Operation Surf, and they bring in military members who've been traumatized for whatever reason through their service. And I get partnered a lot with the women who are part of the program, and every single one of them was sexually assaulted. Every single one of them, and every single one of them is traumatized, and none of them have ever mentioned that they had a lawyer on their side. So I'm not undermining what you said, but I just find it so curious, because you've been doing this work since 2011, and I would hope that I would then not keep finding these women.
So me too. I would hope not too. And so I would love it if you would ask them. And one of the gaps, right, that I think is so true in all of this work is a couple of gaps. One, people don't know that they have these rights. They don't really understand them. So even if someone said to them, you can have a lawyer and you don't have to report the crime, mm-hmm. you might not understand that, or you might not believe it and have faith in it. So we have to get to the place where we educate people and they have faith in that education. They can trust us, right? That's one of the things that's flawed, is the trust in the system. And then the other problem with all of this is that we don't have enough resources, right? I mean, if I'm a military a survivor and someone says to me, oh, you can have a military lawyer, and it was a military person that hurt me, do I want a military lawyer? I don't know. But we also don't have civilian lawyers ready to go. Mm-hmm. So your options are constrained. So I would love it, Elizabeth, if you would talk with them, and I bet we could learn from them how we're still failing.
Yeah. I have so many thoughts that are coming up. We do have a phone call, so we'll hear from our caller, and then we'll pop back in with our thoughts. Who do you have, Francisco?
Elizabeth, I actually have your intern, Sasha Berginski. She actually has a question for our guest today. Sasha, take it away.
Hi, Meg. I was just really fascinated by all the topics you're covering, and I was really curious, just kind of speaking from my own cohort and like the generation of potential future lawyers, I have so many friends who are just really into everything you've been kind of covering up to this point, but they want to pursue this victim advocate path. But at the same time, especially with COVID, they're kind of craving to take a gap year. So I was just curious if there's any internships, job opportunities, any other kind of experience that they can maybe take advantage of and really immerse themselves in this kind of work before they secure themselves in the potential route.
Sasha, that's a great question. And yes, there are so many opportunities. So each community will have some advocacy opportunities, and I'm happy you can connect with me, and you all can post about my contact information and I can help connect you. Our website has some opportunities, ncvli.org. But there are going to be in every jurisdiction, every location, some victim advocacy opportunities, either what's called system-based, so that's like prosecution, law enforcement, or community-based, like rape crisis centers, domestic violence centers, human trafficking centers, right? Hate crimes groups, right? We'll all have opportunities to start to put your toe in advocacy. And then even legal agencies like mine will have opportunities for non-lawyers to start to get into it. And I want to just honor, Sasha, I love that people take gap years. I taught undergraduate for a long time, not a long time. I taught undergraduate for a while. I now teach law school. And I just find folks who have had the opportunity, right? Or who have, you know, been on the path of taking some time off. Such rich conversations come when there's time in between. So for anyone taking a gap year, I hope you have the opportunity to embrace that year. Both play if you can during that year, if you have the resources to take some time where you don't have to work. And then also, yes, find a volunteer opportunity, find an internship opportunity. And absolutely, you can reach out to me and I can help connect people.
Well, and you just sing my song, Meg, because Sasha knows that I really push the service year piece for my students to do a service year before grad school. And I would think that NCVLI, if you're a nonprofit, you'd be a great source of service years under AmeriCorps. So we should talk about that, because then the students can get paid for their year of service and learn these skills.
Absolutely. I think there's many of those opportunities. So I'd love to, Sasha and Elizabeth, I can send you all some information.
So let's then continue this conversation about enough people to provide the services, because this comes up all the time in the mental health field. We need more mental health care. And we don't have the people and we don't really have great mental health care, but that's another show. So let's talk about the legal piece then. How do you have the manpower to cover legal protections for victims' rights? And how do we pay them? Because not a lot of people want to go into the PD work or, you know, to the advocacy work, because it doesn't pay when you can be a corporate lawyer. So tell me about that, because you're a law professor. How do you encourage people to want to do this work?
Yeah, it's a huge problem, right? Public interest law doesn't pay what corporate law does, what law firm life does, in dollars. I believe it pays you in other ways. I'm a much healthier, happier person. So like your opening about kind of caring for yourself so you can care for others, I couldn't have done that if I was a corporate lawyer, right? It wouldn't have been possible for me. It's the way I'm constituted. But that said, how do we pay for it? You know, there are federal dollars available for some of this work. There's a pot of money called the Victims of Crime Act Fund, which funds some of this work. It's insufficient. So that's VOCA. It's insufficient. Every state has some. Those are insufficient. It, from my perspective, is something that we as a community need to turn towards. What do we value, right? You fund the things you value. And you don't fund the things that you undervalue or don't value at all. And I firmly believe that public defense is underfunded, right? Victim services are underfunded. We underfund human services, right? The human side of things. So what are we trying to do to kind of leverage the dollars that exist and grow the dollars? Well, we talk to Congress a lot. We talk to state legislatures a lot to try and fund. We also try to get lawyers who are in those corporate roles to volunteer to take one case a year, right? Mm-hmm. If every lawyer in this country, if every lawyer who listens to this podcast volunteered to take one case, what NCVLI does is we support them. So we'll give them sample pleadings. We'll coach them through arguments. We'll give them trauma-informed 101. How do you sit with a survivor who has been triggered? Like, we'll give training on all of this and we'll hold their hand through a case. And if every lawyer who's making a whole lot of money doing something else just volunteered to take one case, we'd actually be in pretty good stead. So you can go to NCVLA's website and sign up to be a pro bono lawyer and do good in the world.
I love that because I love how the mission statement of NCVLI is about sharing resources and encouraging others. Do we have another call, Francisco?
I mean, yeah, someone, Sandra, left a comment. This is.
But you are muted.
Something's never changed from Zoom. Sandra left a comment that regarding earlier on the show, where she called to say that part of the problem with the resistance to admitting a person as a victim is the way we present ourselves to other people by our appearance, our cars, homes, and social media, which is basically saying to everyone that everything is great in my life, so how can I be a victim? So Sandra wanted to leave a comment for you two there.
Meg, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, right, we wear different personas. We share certain times, we share a public persona that says, I'm not hurt, I'm not sad, I'm not quote unquote weak, right? Because we perceive emotion and we can perceive being victimized as somehow weak, like there's something about us. I have a friend who talks about like the neurobiology of trauma, and he always says, you know, like, it's the brain doing what the brain does, right? To just be like protective of yourself. Well, you know, surviving is just doing what you need to do to survive. So you don't have to claim the victim label if you don't want to. But I do think more authentic conversations about how often we've been hurt, how often life is hard, that's the human condition. And if we could embrace that it's okay to talk about it. I didn't used to talk about being a victim of crime myself. I now talk about it. I talk about how for years I didn't hug people because my own victimization was, there was a weapon put up against my belly. And so every time I hugged someone, it made me think back, right? And not even consciously, subconsciously. And now I think about it and I thought, you know what? It's okay. I can talk about that. I'm not a hugger. And I can explain to you, I'm not a hugger because you know what? It's not comfortable. I was a victim. But for a long time, I just pretended to be strong through it.
So I want to tie this back to what you said about we don't value the human services, because we talked about starting as a public defender. And my daughter Kelly is in law school, and she's all about public interest law and all about being a public defender, because she really believes that those who commit crimes have their own traumas and life story that we're not taking into consideration. We're just all about punishment and making people pay. And so that, how do those two fit together? If you're someone who wants to be a public defender, but you're also someone who wants to support victims' rights, do they work together, or are they at odds with each other?
So I firmly believe that they work together, right? There are human beings, right, who have been hurt, and often, right, the saying hurt people mm-hmm. is accurate. Mm-hmm. Right? Whether it's interpersonally, like, oh, I was hurt by, you know, something that happened at work, and then I take it out on my partner, right? Just verbally even, or whether it's something much more violent, right? I was hurt as a child. And so that's how I believe interpersonal relationships should run, right? So I'll hurt my future partners. We have to pay attention to both. Rights, though, when we get to the legal part of this, rights are about the system being compelled to honor the human beings. Mm-hmm. So defendants do have rights, should have rights, and those rights have to be fought for by lawyers and honored in order to have them honored by courts. Victims can have rights that should be fought for by lawyers and honored by courts, because it's about compelling the system to treat them both well. Mm-hmm. And so we need both. We need really good public defense. We need really good victims' lawyers. Of course, we need good prosecutors who are ethical, right? I will tell you, I though have worked with many victims who want to be heard in the criminal justice system, but not to punish someone. Mm-hmm. They just want to be heard. They might even be the strongest voice for a particular deferral, right? Or diversion out of criminal justice. But if we don't give them their own honoring of their rights, we won't ever hear them. So they really work together. The system has to pay more attention to the individuals, defendant and victim alike. So I never advocate for a victim's right that would trounce a defendant's right. Mm-hmm. Nor would I, as a public defender, advocate for a defendant's right that would somehow erase the victim's right. We have to be more about rights generally and making the system treat people better.
And I guess it comes down to, like you said, understanding the human beings that are involved in this, that these are not robots. These are humans, whether it's an act of violence or sexual assault. These are two human beings who came to this experience or this act from two different life stories, and to pay attention to the stories. And it seems like our biggest challenge is that the institutions that surround us, whether it's criminal justice or police force or even college institutions, whatever the institutions are, they're so rigid that there's not a lot of room for the human beings. Even the military, they're so rigid that the human beings get lost. So how do we get to the bigger picture, which is the institutions themselves?
So, and that's a, Elizabeth, that's a, just a great point. And that's one of the reasons that one of our missions is not just to represent individual victims, but it's to do impact litigation. So we're trying to litigate for the equivalent of a Miranda case, right? The Miranda case compelled law enforcement to at least tell defendants their rights, right? Now, do they always? No. Do they always do it in a way that someone who's accused of a crime understands them, right? Language access, right? Absolutely not, right? We still have flaws, but we had a little foothold in to say, do it better. And now we can say, you're still doing it wrong, do it better. So we do impact litigation the same way that the Miranda case, the Miranda rights came out of a decision where the accused, his name was Miranda, right? And it went all the way up to the US Supreme Court. We're trying to do the same thing, where what we're trying to do is find cases where we could create systemic or institutional change, right? You don't sentence a defendant, you don't hold a sentencing hearing until you, the court, ask, hey, is the victim here? Do they want to be heard? Like, that's not hard. Hit the pause button and ask. But we're actually having to litigate to try to do that. So we are trying to create some systemic change through impact litigation. And that's not a perfect solution. And it's not the only thing we should be doing to create social change in this country, right? Like, social movements have to include education, but they also should include litigation, right? If you look at the civil rights movement, the environmental rights movement, the LGBTQ movement, litigation is a piece of social change.
And it's interesting that you have this buy-in from the military, because I know in the world of psychotherapy, a lot of the work in mental health came up through the military saying, we need these services, create them for us. So I find that really ironic that it's the military themselves that's saying, hey, we have a problem here. We need to create these services. And maybe somehow that, like, if people can go into the military and get their law degree to do that specific work, then they're trained and ready to come out into civilian. I mean, is that part of what you're hoping here?
That is like my secret hope. You've just named it, right? Like, literally, I watched them and I had been doing the work for almost 10 years before we got involved with the military. And now, like, they're a little bit ahead of us in some ways. But I just am waiting for those lawyers to separate from the military and want to do this work in the civilian side, because they're well trained, they're compassionate, they know what they're doing. And I just feel like that's part of it. So, yeah, and to your point, in the military, if you find one champion of an issue who's pretty high up, they can order change, right? They can dictate it in some ways, very different than the civilian side. So sometimes lots of things go wrong in the military, but sometimes you can start a kernel of change in the military and then have it move over to the civilian side.
It's almost like we have to take things at both angles. It partially, we want to tear the institutions down, but until they're torn down, if we can get inside the institution and bring about change.
It's absolutely a both and, right? It's deconstruct that which you have no use for anymore. And also, while you're deconstructing those pieces you don't have use for, be in it so that you can make it as good as possible. I often joke that, you know, my job isn't all that ambitious. My siblings make a lot of fun of me because sometimes I say my job is to make things less bad. Not necessarily good, but
my
less
job
bad.
Too.
Yeah. But if we can make things less bad, then I think we're walking a good path.
So in our last couple minutes, what is it something that you would want people to know about NCVLI or this work that they could carry with them?
So I would hope folks folks would visit our website, so ncvli.org, and in order to just learn a little bit more, because again, I think one of the most important things is know your rights and know victims' rights so that when someone asks you or just discloses even a little bit, right? Because sometimes we don't realize someone's disclosing their victimization to us. They just say something. But if you are ready to say, you know, survivors can be treated better than that, there's this agency that gives them rights and that fights for them, that is creating safe space for that survivor. So learn a little bit more about rights so you can share the rights with others. And then also, everyone who knows a lawyer, ask them to volunteer. Get them to our website. Let's get every lawyer to take a case. It is not rocket science to do the work of being a victim lawyer, but it fills you with enough resilience that you can go on for decades doing more work. If you take one victim's case, I will pretty much guarantee to any lawyer, if you take one victim's case and represent them on their rights, you will have light for a very long time in your life.
And Meg Garvin, how has this work helped your mental health and well-being?
Growing up, I self-identified as a misanthrope. And in fact, my family all said I was a misanthrope. And now I love people. I see, to get to observe resilience, it is like the notion of vicarious trauma we talk about a lot. We do not talk about vicarious resilience enough. It rubs off on you. I am a happier person because I walk with survivors.
Thank you, Meg Garvin. Meg is the executive director of NCVLI, who we've been talking about this past hour. If you want more information, please check out their website, or you can visit our website. I'll have Sasha upload the link through our Facebook page. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I can get you in touch with Meg and her organization if you have any further questions. Meg, thank you so much for volunteering an hour of your day with us. I've loved this conversation. I really have.
Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone who made it happen. I very much appreciate the conversation. And I also have to say, the title of your podcast is perhaps the most brilliant of all time, Reluctant Therapist. I'm just going to steal some of that, I think. I'll give you attribution, though.
I appreciate it. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We'll be back again next Tuesday at 2. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist.